joining us for another episode of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of the Media Twits is brought to you by CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, offering an intensive, cutting-edge, three-semester Master of Arts in Journalism and a unique one-semester advanced certificate in entrepreneurial journalism, and CUNY J-Camp, a series of continuing professional development workshops focused on emerging trends and skill sets in the industry. Learn more at journalism.cuny.edu. Joining me is Rafat Ali in New York. How's it going?
Good, good. How's it going there?
Good. The weather is fine. The traffic is only snarled sometimes from protesting, and it's now gone from the BART station protest in San Francisco to Occupy San Francisco. Yeah, they blocked the entrance to Wells Fargo yesterday.
Oh, for real?
I think 11 people were arrested. So, how are things in New York?
Well, it's been. I'm not going to talk about the weather. It is kind of miserable and cold here. And not cold, but it's kind of drizzly and 51 and pretentious of things to come. So
not a good weather for camping in the park, I take it.
Not a good weather, but there are people here. There's still some. I think Scoble went there last night, and he said there were about 500 people, and this is on a weeknight, which he said he was expecting more people there, down to the Occupy Wall Street crowd. But weekends is when it really picks up.
Yeah, and a lot more people will come. And this weekend there's going to be a march, so I think that'll be a big deal, although I guess you'll miss out on that.
I will. I guess it's going to compete against iPhone 4S launch as well for a lot of those people too. And I wonder what that's going to do. A lot of people will be in the line to buy iPhone 4S and, of course, go to Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I would imagine those would be the similar, similar demographic.
Yeah. What's your take so far? I mean, is it something that, I mean, we've noticed that, you know, no one was talking about it for a while, and now everyone's talking about it, and it seems like it's gone from 0 to 100 so quickly in the media and the coverage.
In the media, it has, but like the people, just regular people, and we are, and I live far away from the Wall Street area by any means, and I'm not anywhere near there by any means. And
right.
And the people that I hang out with or my friends and stuff, we're not talking about Occupy Wall Street. We're just trying to figure out. Everybody's is just going on with their daily lives, trying to sort of do the daily stuff. But I don't know. I mean, it just seems like we feel guilty not putting more into it, but it just doesn't seem to be that big at this point.
Right. Yeah. It seems like it's happening in a lot of places. There's a lot of coverage and people talking about it. But whether they're really, you know, how involved each of us wants to be just varies from person to person, just how much you really want to put into it and how much you really care, I guess. Even if you agree with what people are saying, it does take a lot to get you down to a protest and then actually, you know, camp out and stay there. You really have to believe, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us, like you and I think our thing is we can contribute in sort of digital fashion, virtual fashion, however we can, spreading the word,
right,
and doing what we can. I own OccupyWSJ.com, which is OccupyWallStreetJournal.com, which was the print paper that they've that the protesters are putting out, and I own the domain name, and I told them that if you want, I can just give it to you for free, but nobody responded. So
wait, you own what domain?
OccupyWSJ.com.
Oh, really?
Interesting.
Yes. When did you get that?
That was literally within an hour of them announcing that they're going to launch something called Occupy Wall Street Journal. And I don't think they were that focused on the web of it. And I bought it because I didn't want a squatter to get it and then try and sell it to them.
Right.
My point was, I'll buy it, and then whenever they want it, I can just transfer it. I'm going to transfer it for free. I'm not going to charge anything.
So real quickly, just a rundown, we're going to talk more about Occupy Wall Street. We've got a guest, Arun Gupta, who is the co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal and The Independent, as well as Manola Espinoza, who's the head of audio for SoundCloud, an audio sharing service which a lot of people have been using from the protests. So we'll get his take on that. Then we'll talk a little bit about Netflix giving up on its kind of Quickster idea and trying to split into two companies. And finally, we'll talk a little bit about a Pennsylvania newspaper that wouldn't take down its paywall even during flooding when an emergency was happening in town. Arun is a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, as well as the co-founder of The Independent. Manolo Espinoza is the head of audio for SoundCloud, focused on creating and implementing business strategy for non-music audio content and the growth of SoundCloud recordings within political campaigns, looking to reach out to supporters with a candidate's voice and across social media channels. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Arun, tell us a little bit about the Occupied Wall Street Journal. I know you guys did a Kickstarter campaign. Were you involved in that? How did you get involved in the publication?
Well, the Independent is a free newspaper that's been publishing in New York City for 11 years, and we saw a need for some sort of newspaper to be coming out of the occupation itself. Normally, we do these types of things ourselves. We publish special issues around what we see as big political or historical events, but this time we felt it needed to be a separate publication under its own banner. And so there were just a lot of discussions that we had with various organizers, with other journalists, and through the Independence networks, we pulled together the organization, and we were the ones who actually set up the Kickstarter campaign. And we were trying for a modest goal, just $12,000 in 10 days. But again, through people the Independent works with, like Naomi Klein, the Yes Men, Code Pink, and Michael Moore, they all helped promote the campaign, and it ended up raising more than $75,000 in that 10-day period. So it was a wild success.
And what were you able to do with that money? Did that mean you could have kind of a bigger print run, have more people, pay people more? I mean, how did that help you guys?
No one's getting paid a penny for this. We just made a decision that we wanted the staff to be professional journalists, because this is not an internal organ. This is meant for the public. So we focus on doing a high quality, well designed, well written and edited publication. So all the money is essentially going for printing and distribution. And then there are some various fees and fulfillment costs with the Kickstarter campaign. So that already two issues have already been printed. There was a Spanish edition that was also printed, and they're currently working on issue number 3. At this point, I'm actually on the road traveling to other occupations, so I've stepped back from working on the editorial end, but you know, it's up and running and in good hands.
Now, what made you guys decide to stick with print? And I didn't notice you put in, like, I guess, replicas and PDFs and things online. And why print over a website? Or do you think you'll also do a website sometime down the line?
There is a website that is now up and running, but print is simply irreplaceable. You know, political change happens in the real world, not the virtual world. All this stuff about social media revolutions, you know, is not, I think, very accurate. It's a tool. But what print allows you to do is you can pass a newspaper from hand to hand. You cannot pass a website from hand to hand. It allows you to start conversations. It creates bonds. becomes, you know, the mere act of handing a newspaper to someone is an opportunity to also talk to that person, because people are like, what is this? What's this about? So it's very important to building a political community. And, you know, like I mentioned, we've been doing The Independent 11 years. You get into communities you never would otherwise. People are very self-selecting about the parts of the internet that they use. So you will encounter people from different walks of life, different classes, different ethnic groups when you are actually out in public. And of course, New York City, the density of life in public is so great that it allows the opportunity to engage with huge communities you can never otherwise encounter.
You're saying you're not that particularly keen on social media, but don't you think that the word would not have spread about the movement itself without the use of social media?
Well, I'm not saying that I'm not keen. It's a tool, and it can be a powerful tool, but we have to view these as integrated. It's not one or the other. It's not social media or print or broadcast. These work best in conjunction with each other. And, you know, I do get this question asked all the time, why print? And it's just, why not print? You know, like I said, we do exist in the real world. And sure, the social media did help spread the campaign. The social media has helped people bypass what they see as biased or poor reporting by the mainstream news media. But this is what I focus on personally, print, because I think it has a strong future. The economics of it have changed a little. I think you're better off doing a free newspaper now than a paid publication, but people are hungry for good information, especially as the mainstream media concentrate more and more on fluff like celebrity gossip and cute cat videos. There becomes a huge opening for serious journalism.
So how do you see what you're doing or what sort of media that's coming out of there doing in terms of trying to take what seems to be from an outsider's perspective? So how can media like yours help us wrap our heads around it?
Well, I think, you know, just simply explaining things. For one, the whole demands issue is like there is no lack of demands. Yes, there may not be one central demand coming from this movement, but it's because you cannot fit humanity into a 5-second soundbite, and also because there's no one single demand, because there is no one single problem stemming from the global economic and financial crisis. So you have people who don't have jobs or don't have meaningful jobs, students who can't get into college or who are coming out of college with huge debts, people who don't have health care, people who don't have housing or have their homes foreclosed upon, on and on and on. And so what we do is we're using these types of media, the print, the social media, to get these ideas out there, to explain to the general public. It's a way of trying to bypass, I think, the mainstream media. And also part of it is prefigurative. People want to have a sense that they are creating a new society, because the demands are not just about policy or politics. People don't have, I think a lot of them have much interest in electoral politics. They want to see a new society, a new way of relating to each other. And part of this is having their own media.
What about Adbusters? I know they were kind of involved in the embryonic part of this movement and were calling for the action to start with. Are they involved at all in your publication, or do you feel like they have any part in it still?
Well, I think, you know, they certainly, what they did was very important, and that it should be recognized as such. In terms of this publication, there's been very, very little contact, and that's totally fine, because we're trying to set this up as its own project. And that the way these protests work is it's a coming together of all sorts of groups and individuals, but people are able to act autonomously. There is no centralized control. There's no one calling the shots. That's part of the reason it has been so successful. It is a leaderless movement that people can come into and feel they actually have political power, that they have some sort of say in a process. And that's what we're also finding when we talk to people. so many people are saying, like, you know, I felt I had no power. I felt my hands are tied, that these things are happening to me and the world, and I had no say. But I come here and I'm inspired and I'm hopeful. So this the whole nature of this protest is it is giving people inspiration and hope. It is allowing them to do something different, but it is not any one single force that is behind it. It is a true coming together of a large community, which I think is a great thing, and I think that is the ideals of the type of democracy we want.
And tell me about what you're doing now. Are you still going to be involved in the publication, or are you just kind of reporting from other places for it, or what's going on with your tour?
We just started the tour. We are going down to Washington, D.C. We'll be visiting Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia in the next few days. I'm in touch with other people who are telling me what's going on in various cities. But we want to see what's going on the ground ourselves, because the thing about New York City is it's saturated with media. There's a tendency for New York to drive the media coverage and even protest politics. But what is going on in a lot of these other cities are reflections of the local movements that are there. So we want to see what's actually going on the ground, and then we'll be going across the country, through the Midwest, through the South, to the West Coast, to really get a feel for what these occupations are trying to do, how they relate to the local power structures. It's a remarkable moment now that there are over 100 active occupations going on across the country. And I think it's a very hopeful moment. And, you know, I'll get back to that point. The reason that these occupations have exploded is because they're giving people a sense that they can actually be an active participant in political and social life, and not just exist as a consumer or as an observer to a process that they have no input into other than to flip a lever every 4 years.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us on the show.
Thank you.
So, Manolo, just turning to what you've experienced with the protests at SoundCloud, when did you start noticing things going on SoundCloud that were related to the Occupy movement?
Thanks, Mark. SoundCloud started, we're a leading audio platform, so we focus on helping other people record audio sounds, right? And what we noticed was that journalists like Dan Patterson from ABC News Radio was pretty active early on. We also noticed that people were using it to field record audio during these protests, be it in New York or here in San Francisco. So it's been going on for probably about a month now.
I noticed there are songs on there. There's, these radio reports, kind of firsthand reports. Where do you think it fits into all the other kind of online tools that people are using in this protest?
Sure. I think, as Arun mentioned earlier, you know, the movement is about people coming together, right? And oftentimes, part of that is to be able to express yourselves in a true and authentic way. And I think simple audio recording done by, you know, using our app. We have an app that's for the iPhone as well as one for the Android. And it allows you to record stuff very, very quickly and publish it on the web. And it captures the sincerity of the protest or of the movement. And that simplicity and being able to publish it and share it with your Facebook or Twitter followers very quickly is absolutely part of that movement. We've grown organically. We've seen ordinary citizens taking their sounds and using our platform to push their stories and moments across the internet. And that's what excites us about this.
What about, now I know you're involved with political campaigns too. Do you see any of them using this? And how would you imagine a candidate using something like SoundCloud?
So what we've noticed is that candidates will see YouTube as an important part of getting their message across to their users. But oftentimes they'll have a handful of recordings done on YouTube, maybe five or six. Yet the candidate is out every day. at forums, at debates, at meetups, talking about their positions and raising awareness. It's much, much easier to do it via audio. And what we're noticing here in the San Francisco mayoral election is that candidates are using it to take simple audio clips and put it up on Facebook and reach out to their supporters. What we're also starting to see is that they're leveraging SoundCloud to get the sentiments from their supporters out. You know, oftentimes, you heard this back in the 2008 campaign with Obama, the importance of the stories of self, right? The stories of who I am as a voter and how I can connect with the candidate that I support. And getting those sounds, those stories to the people that you influence is very important as well. So I've had great conversations with field organizers connected to the mayoral candidates here on how they want to use it to record stories from people in the neighborhood and be able to share that through social media, because they see the importance of social media and they see audio capture being much easier than, you know, YouTube, for example.
Are you thinking about helping them on distribution as well, or is it just more sort of platform and do what you want to do with it?
So we are a platform, and you know, in the same way that you see YouTube being used to record and then the candidates putting links to those YouTube videos on Facebook or on Twitter or Tumblr, etc., that's what they're going to be doing with SoundCloud recordings. We're also working with journalists, however, who want to have those recordings and share them on their blogs as well as through their own social media channels.
You guys are really, your business model is around just, you know, people pay for the amount of audio that you guys store for them. Is that the model for the most part?
Yes, we have a tiered pricing model. So it starts at free, and then it goes up to a professional model.
And is there going to be advertising in it as well, or is that something you don't want to add?
No, right now we're focused on the current business model and expanding the platform so that other journalists, reporters, musicians, artists, everyday folks can use it to not only capture audio but also to publish it and share it. And, you know, we've gotten a very excited community around what we do, and we're pretty happy with, you know, being in the current space and helping expand the use of social sounds online.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us on the show.
Thanks, Mark.
So now let's talk about Netflix, kind of changing from the political into the kind of video and streaming world. You know, Netflix kind of took a lot of flack for first, you know, raising their rates as high as they did, 60%, and then deciding on this kind of Quickster idea. Now, after taking a lot of flack for that, they're backing down and saying, okay, we're not going to launch Quickster. You know, in the meantime, they've lost, I think, at least 1 million subscribers, maybe more. I mean, does this kind of take a little bit of the shine off of Netflix as being this kind of white knight for everyone?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was for you were said, let's move from the political to the streaming. I was going to say political to the sublime. It was just a bizarre move to begin with, and sort of when the switch was also equally bizarre. Reed Hastings, who two months ago, was the darling of the media industry. Spoke at all kinds of conferences, is on the Microsoft board, which is a huge, huge honor for any CEO to be. Yeah. And has been, of course, been case studies written about him and the company and all that stuff. And suddenly in the last 2 months, it's just been hammered from all sides. I think the reality is, in a lot of these cases, these businesses are at the mercy of the overlords. It's like the music industry. I always say the music industry eat their young, and it's sort of the same with the movie industries. That it just seems in the long run, Netflix and Hulu kind of businesses just seem transitory businesses to ultimately how the users are going to end up consuming it. And a completely new companies would probably emerge out of those. So It just seems that I think Netflix is going through those sort of cycles that you would expect in these kind of businesses. And these kind of changes will only keep on accelerating. It's not like we're going to settle down into something. So it just seemed so bizarre. I don't know what your thought. I mean, did you think that the first time when they did it was a brave move on their part to launch, to sort of spin off?
Yeah, the spinoff, the raising the prices, I kind of understood, and I think we talked about it with Stacy when she was on the show at one point. And you know, we both kind of understood, hey, they're trying to raise the rates because their costs are going up, and you know, they're trying to do original productions, and you know, maybe even their costs weren't high yet, but maybe they just anticipated having to kind of bid on things, and now with Dish and Blockbuster, you know, think that competition is stronger. But the spinoff part of it, that really took me by surprise. I wasn't ready. I understand what they're saying by doing it. I understand the strategy. You know, DVDs are going to go away. It's all going to be streaming. You know, we all know that that's kind of the future. But does that mean that, you know, you should make it into a separate company and, you know, really confuse people and with this weird kind of throwback name that, you know, obviously didn't really jive with anybody? And then there was the weird, you know, Twitter handle by, you know, this guy who might not have wanted to give up that name. And so it's just, there was a lot of strange stuff around it. You know, why didn't they check on Twitter ahead of time? And, you know, did they test this name and this idea? It just seems like they kind of threw it out there. And maybe that's what happens when you're really successful. You just feel like you're on a roll and you can kind of do anything and not have to worry about what people think.
Yeah, or you could say the opposite side, that they were so successful and they realized that they have to disrupt themselves before anybody else does. And I guess your point is that you understand the rationale. It's just that the implementation was just weird.
Yeah, and I think it, maybe the timing was wrong too. That, you know, this wasn't the moment to split up those services. And maybe it doesn't have to be split up. You know, maybe it just slowly goes away in whatever way it does. But does it really have to be a separate company? You know, I don't know. I mean, did AOL, you know, split off its dial-up? Not really. It kind of kept it in the same company. It could have spun it off. I guess you just have to think about what are the business aspects, what are the positives in having, you know, two different companies, you know, or two different services, and who's going to want to be a part of the company that's just going to go away? You know,
yeah.
What
plus
do you...
the fact that they were like, from a user experience perspective, I mean, you and I talked about this before, I think on a previous show, was you had to log into, well, separately. Data from one was not supposed to be moved over to the data from the other.
Right, two different queues.
It was all, from a customer service user experience perspective, it was terrible. And I guess that's really what mattered in the end.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, they backed off on this plan. They're going to stick to just Netflix being Netflix. You know, they're sticking by the price hike, and they're going to be announcing, I think, in a couple weeks what their numbers are as far as subscribers. So we'll definitely, you know, keep following it. These kind of these video streaming wars, you know, it's interesting to watch, and I'm hopeful that, you know, us as, you know, video watchers and consumers will end up winning because there's kind of this war going on.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see what we'll be talking about exactly a year from today, where the future of Hulu, at least in the medium term, would have been decided. Probably by then, whether they would have stayed independent or they would have been bought, they would be bought by somebody. Netflix, a picture will be a lot clearer. Some of the stuff, the other boxes and stuff that have come, Roku versus Apple, remains to be seen whether Apple TV and iTunes and video and stuff will do something more than what they've done till now. So it'd be fascinating a year from now to see what the, and I think it'll be a lot different. I think the needle would have moved a lot further ahead, hopefully.
Yeah, and the other question is the TV Everywhere, you know, attempt to really put a lot more online, and HBO Go and all these other services. You know, will they add something to let people without cable access it for a fee. I mean, that could change the whole dynamic if they actually open those things up and make them, available for people like us who cut the cord.
That's true. Yeah, that's the biggest question. Yeah.
So the last thing we'll talk about, probably not in too much depth, but this newspaper in Pennsylvania that has their kind of paywalls up. They have a very strict paywall. It's the Bloomsburg Press Enterprise. And when there was this big floods that happened after the hurricane in September, a lot of the people said, you should open up the paywall, let people get access to it, even if you're not a print subscriber. And while I think they did suspend the paywall for a few days, they were very strict about it, and basically their response was, if you want to get our content, you're going to have to buy the newspaper. And in the meantime, the readers and some people put together their own kind of community site called the Bloomsburg Daily, which I guess was doing pretty good reporting about the floods. So I guess, this kind of push and rush to do paywalls, I mean, now there was a story in paid content about even college newspapers putting up paywalls.
I saw the headline. I mean, I guess they're just making it a lot easier for entrepreneurs to do what they really do best. And I wonder, is the Bloomsburg Daily, have they said that they want to continue after?
That's a good question. Like, will this thing that just popped up, like, will they have long-term viability? Because, we've seen that in the past where something, popped up as a result of, a strike. I mean, Salon was kind of launched out of a strike, to the newspapers in San Francisco, and ended up obviously being kind of a long-term publication. But you wonder about things like this where they kind of – these kind of quick and dirty sites that pop up, like, will it survive? And I guess if there's enough people in the community who are upset with the daily paper having a paywall – why not? Why wouldn't people go to alternative sources? I mean, that's kind of the one issue with paywalls, is that if you make the paywall so strict that no one can get your content and people don't want to get the print paper, that leaves people just deciding, well, am I going to pay $2.50 a week for this website, or, am I just going to find the information on another competing site?
Yeah, and I guess, it also is newspaper and the publisher, probably in this case, forgetting some of the public value that really newspapers should adhere to, and there was a higher purpose than making money, and I guess it was in this case where there isn't that many sources of information for it, this would have been a good and in the long run from a brand perspective, wouldn't this have helped a lot more than actually harmed them?
Right, as far as, saying, hey, we're going to be good citizens and open up our paywall just, during this flood and, for whatever amount of time until this disaster is over, we're going to basically open this up for you as kind of a good Samaritan thing, and maybe that would get them more subscriptions.
Yeah, and there are ways to work around it, which is if they had it free and do, because it's a very local paper, do some sort of an event after that you ask people to show up to and donate for the money that the paper has lost. I mean, there are ways to do it and help them become more loyal. They just probably didn't think on their feet.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Media Chwits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Along with my co-host, Rafat Ali, we want to thank our special guests, Arun Gupta, as well as Manola Espinoza, and our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to follow all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.
one down.